Podcasting from Alexandria, Virginia, just a few miles from Washington, D.C., where we all hope doing what is right the first time is everyone's top priority. This is Software Quality Today, presented by TX3 Services, where we empower life science companies to digitally transform their software testing. This is a podcast for industry professionals about the trends and challenges of software quality testing, computerized systems validation, and the people who are leading the way. We'll be providing you with interviews from special guests as well as news from thought leaders at leading life sciences organizations and vendors alike. This episode's guest, Ed Hine, is here to share his personal views and opinions as an individual subject matter expert, and the views and opinions herein are not necessarily shared by his employer, LifeScan, nor should any mention of products or solutions be interpreted as commercial endorsements by LifeScan. And now, here's your host, Dory Gonzalez Azevedo.
Welcome to another episode of Software Quality Today, presented by TX3 Services. I'm your host, Dory Gonzalez Acevedo. Today, I'll be interviewing Ed Hine, Manager of Digital Verification and Validation of LifeScan Global Corporation. Ed has over 30 years of experience in software quality, biopharmaceutical and medical device R&D, and manufacturing. He's one of my go-to colleagues for all things related to process and test automation and best practices in CSV. His contribution to our client advisory roundtables and product focus group has helped TX3 continue to refine our Vera product in practical and pragmatic ways. I first met Ed when he was at GSK in the early 2000s, just when Part 11 came out, and many of us were still in and on the manufacturing floor at the time, trying to figure out how to incorporate electronic records and electronic signatures into our validation programs. After his time at GSK, he moved on to Honeywell's Process Automation Group, where he led equipment and process automation, performing DCS implementations as well as other integrated solutions. Now at LifeScan, he oversees the development and implementation of testing strategies for web and native mobile app testing. He incorporates Vera into a robust test automation framework to support LifeScan's glucose meters and their associated apps. Ed's early adoption of advanced testing tools and risk-based testing methodologies has been a perfect fit to support LifeScan's digital footprint growth. In addition to being an avid cyclist, he holds 3 American Society for Quality certifications: Certified Software Engineer, Certified Manager of Quality Operational Excellence, and Certified Quality Auditor. Please enjoy our conversation. So welcome, Ed, to Software Quality Today with TX3 Services. Thank you.
Thanks, Dory. Thanks for inviting me. Look forward to some discussion.
Yeah. It's been a while since we chatted. I know we've done some stuff in the past, and I'm really anxious to get to hear what you've been up to since that last kind of, it's been a rough year, right?
Sure. Yeah. And we've definitely stayed busy. That's for sure.
Have you? So tell me more about that, because I know we at TX3 have been super busy, and especially picking up like crazy. How has it been for you?
Well, I think the one thing that the whole COVID has brought out is more of a need for digital presence for our customers, because customers aren't going in to see their doctors or clinicians or healthcare professionals. A lot more things are being done online. I know I personally, apart from an annual physical, most of the visits I've done, even for COVID screenings and things, have all been online and virtual. And even, you know, put your iPhone up to your ear or your throat and that
right.
sort of thing.
Isn't that weird?
Yeah. It's kind of funny. But I guess the way the cameras are, and they can do that sort of thing.
They can do it. Yeah.
But it really drove home the fact that there's so much more we can do digitally and services and we can provide to our customers who have diabetes and diabetic patients who we serve to get more information in the healthcare provider's hands and to help them make better decisions using graphs and logs and things. So our company has placed a greater emphasis and invested more on the digital side of the business, which is where we operate in.
Nice. So tell me a little bit about what you do in your current role and what you guys are working on today.
My role as the manager of our verification and validation team is to qualify all of our products, native mobile apps, websites, and backend databases that serve our healthcare providers and customers. And we exchange data between blood glucose meters and native mobile apps, and also direct via USB cables to PCs. So we take that blood glucose data that our patients get, put them into our applications, and they can also enter in lots of other information. And that's the other thing that we're expanding on now is things like meals, calories, exercise, that sort of thing. We're trying to automate integration with other tools.
Fitbits. That's really cool.
Apple watches and things to get data in there for our patients so they can get a total health picture through our application and not just plot their, you know, blood sugar, but other components.
But how that relates to what your intake is, and so that you get the holistic view of, did I do well today? Because glucose changes all the time, right? Like and literally all parts of the day, right? So how does that all look and the ups and downs? That is really super neat.
My team is responsible for doing all of the in sprint and formal testing that we submit to the FDA for 510K filings or follow-up filings for changes we make to our products, new functions and features. So that's what presents the challenge to us. And we've continued on with hot fixes, quarterly releases, monthly releases. So it's been a pretty fast cadence that we've been able to maintain, even though I haven't seen many or any of my coworkers actually, other than virtually like we are, for over a year now.
Wow. So last time we chatted, like, I remember you telling me about you had like this whole room of all these different mobile devices and like this whole system to be able to track and maintain all of your different, you know, permutations of what you need to do. Is that still kind of how you do it today, or has that changed at all?
Well, yeah, we use a mix of virtual devices and simulations in the Apple case and real handheld mobile devices, as well as emulators. So we have the biggest hardware presence. We have a huge inventory of not only our products, the meters that we use, but smartphones that we have a matrix of testing that we do, again, both informally and formally for every release. And through our automation partners with Perfecto Mobile, they have devices cradled in the cloud up in Boston. And some are dedicated cradles for our company. Some are public cradles that any client of theirs can access.
Oh, that's interesting. So there's like a public public cloud of devices that you can literally go in and tap into for what you need, depending on what you guys are launching?
Yeah, they have over 100 different devices and operating systems that are available. Unfortunately, we generally would only run like a production version of our native mobile apps on those. So if we want to run the kind of in process, the beta versions and the release candidates prior to production, pre-production, we use our dedicated cradles that we have. And you still need to secure some licensing, I guess, with them in order to use the public cradle. It's not general public, so to speak. Right.
Right.
So yeah, but all of our test plans, like I said, include a matrix of devices that we like to test on various operating systems and manufacturers, particularly on the Android side, where you have Google, Samsung, LG, lots of different.
There's so many, right? Yeah. There's lots of different things. But I think what's interesting about that, the concept of, historically old school validation, right? You would never share a public, you know, production testing thing, right? Like that wouldn't have happened in a decade ago.
Yeah. And we certainly don't do that for our formal testing though, either. We don't use those public devices, but a lot of times what they'll do is they'll offer, a beta version of a new iOS or operating system that's coming out on a device in that public cloud. So we can run our production app right off of Google Play or the App Store. And just run like a common regression test on that new version that's coming out to test some of the functionality.
So you must have like a whole, like your release process in and of itself sounds like it's complicated.
I guess it can be. There's a lot of regression testing that we do, and we try to automate as much as possible. But it generally is fairly focused. We try to focus the releases around one platform, right? So it'll be the native apps on iOS or Android, or website, or front end web versus back end. So we try to maintain a little bit of focus and differentiation that way. Also, API interfaces have been big in partnering with other companies to share data so that healthcare or the health management companies like Kaiser or Blue Cross can access patient data and help manage patients, because it's cheaper for them to manage a diabetic and keep them out of the hospital than to have them get into trouble with a hypoglycemic or hyperglycemic event and wind up, you know, going blind getting amputation, something like that. You know, all kinds of bad stuff can happen there. So
right. So you guys are finding partnerships in places where those are increasing, I would think. Those sorts of partnerships are increasing as you guys are expanding.
Yeah. Absolutely. And so we've got a lot of automated testing around API interfaces and things as well. Yep.
Cool. So what are the things, what has changed? Like, because you've been doing this now for several years, because I think...
Almost 6 years now I've been at LifeScan. Yeah, it's my first kind of foray. My, as you're aware, I come from more of a distributed control system background, biopharmaceutical R&D. So, and also with Honeywell, I was there for 7 years testing DCS on the development side, software development side, pre-release, pre-production. So I've kind of combined those two things together to, in this environment where first foray into native mobile apps, but the web and web backend data exchange is kind of new. So it's been interesting for me. Yeah.
And so what has changed? So 6 years, that's a good chunk of time. Like I'm envisioning kind of more traditional CSV sort of approach when you started, but probably has evolved.
The whole process is different for native mobile apps, because I don't think the FDA really has everything pinned down on how they want to manage it. So it's fairly laxed, and from my opinion, I mean, for the 510K filing process and the change management process around the native apps is far different than, say, you know, a biopharmaceutical reactor that you're going to produce R&D injectable materials in.
Right, much
more stringent. So I've kind of enjoyed that. Now, where we've kind of, in reading some of the sample questions that you had, there's the tools that we use too, as you're aware, you know, like the Vera tool that TX3 offers, Qtest and ALM, some of the quality management tools. So in working with our IT team and qualifying those tools, that's another area that my team had been involved with more so when we were part of J&J before the Johnson & Johnson sold our company off, because the J&J, their central IT group, didn't really want to get involved in some of the automation and the one-off things that we were doing, and they wouldn't support us in that regard. So we were on our own, but that was fine. Now we've stood up a new IT function that's more productive, I guess, and interactive and managing to test a lot of that stuff on their own. But we're still engaged with that in terms of tool selection for performance testing and things like that. We've gotten more and more into that advanced metrics and performance test for the website backends and data management, that sort of thing.
I see. I often think of the type of work that you do and the testing that you do, and think of you on the you know, level four, level five on a testing maturity perspective, because you guys have to consider so much more. Is that a true assessment?
I'd like to think that, yeah. We're in that and you're talking about like the CMI.
CMI, level.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think we're getting there, because we do track quite a few metrics around the test efficiency, the percentage of automation that we have, and trying to constantly refine the automated tests and get better.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Do you have different teams doing that sort of thing, or is it one team that does look from a test automation perspective, as well as, you know, like new features, and you might have to do some manual testing, but then move into automation?
That's the other thing that's different with LifeScan too, is this is my first entry into agile environments and using Scrum teams. And we've had as many as 10, 11 different Scrum teams that are working on different functionalities for different areas of the platforms, you know, one
all at the same time, and they all feed into the one device.
Correct. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a lot of moving parts.
Exactly. Yeah. So we'll have test leads, and some of them are spread between different Scrum teams, but we have specific you know, automation testers for mobile versus web and API. Manual testers that are specifically dedicated to, you know, hybrid or manual testing. So it's pretty complicated. You're right. And we've recently, we have a new development manager within the last year, and we're moving towards a single trunk delivery methodology. So that's another kind of new development that we've had.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. What are some of the challenges that you've seen with having all those multiple parts and multiple teams, and any lessons learned there of how maybe you want to change that? Or,
well, that's one of the other things that I've done that's I kind of take pride in. When I first came on board, we were a little resource light, but we were kind of like the little kid's soccer team, where, you know, everybody on test and development would chase after the biggest problem. You know, so if you had a release that had to get out and there were some bugs that had to be addressed, they'd pull in all the development people to work on it and all the testers.
That sounds like my team.
Then, you know, the other projects are just sitting there and their schedules are getting blown. And even though they're not at the end point where they need to get done, they're still slipping and you're losing ground. And so we've made great strides more recently in dedicating resources towards maintenance versus new product development. So we have specific Scrum teams keyed in towards maintaining the products versus new product development, new functions and features, and dedicating other Scrum teams to that. So it's, like I said, aligning these sort of independent columns where, you know, you have specified testers and developers that have worked together consistently on different product lines and different platforms.
But then they all come together, right? So the release combines all of their threads of work.
Yes. Yeah. And there's definitely integration testing and we work to do regression testing across the board once all of the platforms come together.
Do you actually get like customer feedback as well? Like customer, but like true customer bugs, like, cause it's direct to customer devices, right?
Yes. We do actually. I'm just working on one of those today. one of the other roles I serve is we have an anomaly review committee. So as you're aware, you know, you don't typically fix all the bugs that go out into production. So there's known anomalies that you have to publish and produce to the FDA. So there's a committee of regulatory affairs, medical affairs, quality assurance, test, customer service that all come together. And those representatives can decide whether a normal, trivial or minor issue. And they're typically things like color shades a little bit off, some text overlaps, or you cut off some text in a translation. You know, it's typically never anything major or urgent. So we do quite a bit of, I guess, discussion around what we do, what we can and can't release with.
That's interesting because I can only imagine because it's direct to customer, right? Like there's, you probably get some pretty absurd comments as well, right? Like not just
most of that gets filtered out before it gets.
Oh, good. All right. So you don't get to see all that. And just to be clear, so your glucose meters do not do insulin injections as well, correct? Or do they?
No. Yeah. When Johnson & Johnson broke up their diabetes, we did have a pump division and we were working with them. Actually, I think that was J&J's goal was to develop the artificial pancreas, right?
At some point.
But they sold off. Actually, what they did was they sold the pump customers to Medtronic, one of our competitors, who had a much larger market share than what the LifeScan pumps had, our pain pumps.
Gotcha.
We don't do any delivery. So it's really up to the patient to do a bolus injection or an insulin injection or adjust their pump. So.
Gotcha. Because once you add that, then there's a whole nother level, right? So maybe CSA models does not apply to you guys because you are product, right? Like, I mean, but I'm sure you're familiar with this whole computer assurance model that's been going around, this kind of reinventing, in my opinion, reinventing CSV again, right? And talking about how to apply best principles and do risk-based approach and do testing better. Have you heard about that or is not really in your area?
Well, the whole risk-based approach thing has been out there for quite a few years now. And we do have risk assessment forms that we fill out. But again, that's primarily, it's both for our products and the tools that we've implemented it. So we have, you know, and I'm somewhat engaged in both of those processes, more so on the product side, obviously. Mm-hmm. But yeah, we do have risk assessment forms that we complete as part of the process to determine what level of testing that we do.
Right. And so you do that on the product side as well, right? So from your tools implementation as well as your product side.
Yep.
And so when you're going through your testing, you guys are super clear about the degree of testing that you need to do, boundary testing and all that sort of stuff. It's not just a like for like. These are your requirements and we're going to do everything. You really take effort to make sure you're testing the most appropriate things.
Yeah, focusing in on the critical requirements. And then typically the negative testing, boundary testing is all done on an exploratory basis. So it's not generally done formally. Most of our formal test is geared around requirements based.
So that's great. So tell me a little bit about your exploratory testing. So you still expect, right, testers to record that, correct?
Yes, but it doesn't require the sign-off and the rigor that you do on the formal side. So we capture, it can typically just be like a checklist in the spreadsheet or something like that, that we retain to prove that certain tests were run.
So you're not necessarily using your tools. You might just use an Excel to do that, or are you still capturing that information in your tools?
We're moving towards trying to capture those spreadsheets in Q-Test in our quality management tool. And and those tests typically aren't as structured, so it's not a step-by-step, verbatim as a formal test would be. So it's not completely reproducible or as reproducible, but it's just a list of different functions and features that have been checked off. And in many cases, we still do a lot of automation for the in-sprint or informal testing that we do as well. So you might have an automation test that runs, dozens or hundreds of times throughout a development cycle, depending how long it is. And we may elect to run it formally once or maybe not if it doesn't address a specific requirement or if it's not related to a requirement that's being modified or a new feature for that release.
Tell me a little bit about your automation testing. So I know in the traditional sense, like automation testing does require some maintenance, right? You guys do a lot of automation testing. Like, are you spending a lot of time maintaining those, or is it stable enough that you're able to, reuse those a lot before you have to maintain?
Yeah, we've built up a library of hundreds of automation tests on both the mobile and the website and API, and the maintenance is a key part of it. And that's one reason that I always kind of get beat up by my boss, like, why do we still need these automation engineers? And I'm like, well, the scripts need to be maintained, because as you change features and move things around on your websites and in your mobile apps, you've got to revise the scripts to account for that. And I think we do a pretty good job of monitoring. Obviously, any failures that you get, there's five key areas. It's typically either an environment failure on our side or the automation platform or test data or an actual bug or the script that's broken. So and the majority of the time, it's not an actual bug. It's one of those other things, environment failures or script problems or things. But, for that 1 in 10 bug that you find, that's really where the automation pays off.
Yeah. So I like that you say that and really articulate that. And I know one of the things when I talk to the higher level, executives, they always want to know, what is my ROI going to be on my test automation tools that I'm purchasing, right? And I really struggle with trying to educate them about, that depends, right? Like, that depends on what you automate. And, if you're really evaluating, are these the right things to automate? And how often would those things change in the future? And to your point, you're still going to need automation engineers around. It's not like they're going to go away, right?
And it's kind of a fine line, because if you build up and get that library of hundreds of tests, you it could become burdensome at some point, right? And one thing I think we could do better is to get the development engineers more engaged and understanding the automation tools and how the scripts are written, because a lot of times there's little things, there's subtle changes that they'll make, moving a little locator ID in the native app or something, or moving stuff around a website that might not be 100% necessary, but it breaks a whole bunch of scripts.
And your developers don't know that because they don't understand the relationship between the two.
Exactly, yeah.
Is that what it is? Interesting. So it's because I often think, right, obviously the test automation needs a specific skill set, right? And it also depends on what type of automation you're doing, right? What type of, UFT or Tosca or whatever you're using, right? Mm-hmm. That's a unique skill set. But the developers don't necessarily have any of those skills.
Right. Or, they should be engaged and want to do quick unit tests and things like that. So we're trying to get them more familiar with the tools that are available and work more closely with the test side for that.
What testing do you use there for automation tests? What are you using? Well, one type or a whole slew of types of?
There's a bunch of different types. So the Perfecto platform that we have uses Appium, which is like a Selenium-based scripting that they've integrated with their reporting platform. On the API side, we use a SmartBear product called Load UI or Ready API, SoapUI Pro. I've heard it called a bunch of different names.
Yeah.
But we're kind of migrating away from that, going more towards QAF, which is an open source tool that InfoStretch, one of our vendors, provides, a Qmetry automation framework. And that allows you to do both web testing scripts and API tests. So we're going kind of in that direction. We use BlazeMeter and JMeter for some of our performance testing on that side. And we look at other options available from time to time.
Right.
But that's the primary ones. I think one of the key things that we've brought in too is doing that continuous integration, continuous development. So when a build gets produced and comes out of Bitbucket into Jenkins, it automatically launches a series of regression tests. And the one thing we've learned from different sessions, I know one of your questions was about how to, you know, doing continuing ed and how do you stick with that kind of stuff through the pandemic. I've done a lot of online sessions through various vendors and societies, even you guys, TX3 has done a few things that have been really good. And then you learn quite a bit, you know, how to produce an automation script. It should be a pretty simple 10, 20 steps maximum, not a real long 50 or 100 scripts, because you really just focus in and try to find one thing, you know, we're trying to break one thing or prove one thing works with the given script. And kind of in that vein also, like I mentioned, we have hundreds of tests for the native mobile apps. And you don't want to run all of them in one regression batch that's going to run for 6 or 7 hours. If it breaks an hour in, then you just lost the rest of that time. So
So you have to section them up so that they run and kick off at different points. And so they
we've kind of divided them up into 1 to 3 hour sets that are more focused around, you know, the login functionality, this feature or the logbook feature, things like that, you know. So we've kind of divided them up so that we can select them based on the release modifications that are going through. And then also in that same vein, so if something fails, you don't have a device that's sitting there idle for, 6 hours or 7 hours.
Right.
And when the offshore testers in India come online to analyze what failures and results you have, they're not seeing that, you know, we kind of blew it on our testing.
Yeah. But what we're talking about right now is there's a lot of thought process that has to go into like that test automation framework and how that's all going to, what's your strategy for that, right? Like that is not just around the tools. And some of the things that I often get, you know, asked about a lot is, well, we just want to use this tool because this is the best tool. But my argument is it doesn't necessarily mean that's the best tool. It's also talking about the strategy of what you just laid out, right? Like that is super important, right?
Oh yeah. Yeah, and we've kind of learned that through trial and error.
Right. And so it might not be the first thing that you do right off the bat, right? But it's that continuous look at, okay, so how can we do this better and how do we fail forward fast, right? Like all of that stuff. And I wonder, I imagine, I didn't ask you this, but you do use different vendors in order to help supplement your testers, right? Like
Yes, we do.
Right. So it's juggling those vendors with different skill sets, right? So who puts together the overall architecture? Is it your team? Like this is the strategy.
We rely on the full-time employees to try and, you know, take the advice from the different vendors that are out there, do the tools analysis and things. Sometimes we do that in conjunction with our vendors and sometimes just independently. But yeah, it's really, one of the guys who works for me, Ray, who does a lot of that analysis and makes those recommendations. And the vendor typically just does the execution and they develop a lot of tests. And as I said, when you start out, if you only have 25 or 50 tests, it might be fine to run all that in regression all at once. But over time, we've learned to bucket them or break them up into different buckets and even, you know, retire some or have some sit out that doesn't pay.
Yeah.
And then there's also smoke testing. So that's more release specific for, when you're in a sprint and you develop some functionality in one sprint and then you're moving into the next one, you typically can't have an automation test running until you have working code. So you develop an automation test for the content delivered in sprint one and then run that during the next sprint to make sure that none of that content is broken. So that's the smaller subset of, it's similar to regression, but a smoke test that just runs in a CI/CD build delivery mode like that, right away to make sure that the recent content built in the previous sprint isn't broken.
So being on the quality side, I would think that some of your quality folk have had to be educated along this process as you've evolved. Is that fair?
I'll say this about LifeScans people, because coming out of other pharmaceutical clients when I was a consultant for a while and at GlaxoSmithKline, there's a lot of quality assurance people who are just like policemen. You know, they write you a ticket and they tell you, you go fix it, you know, and they don't necessarily work with you. And it can be kind of unreasonable at times when they take you to a hard line. And I think the quality people, I've really enjoyed that at LifeScan, that have been really willing to work with us and pretty reasonable. And it may be part of that is because it's not quite as stringent, like I said, as producing R&D injectables, right?
Right.
But it's still in a regulated environment. And I think a lot of that has to do sort of with the personnel attitude as well on the quality assurance side.
Yeah. Fair enough. So forward thinking, are there things that on the technology side, whether from a, you know, literally the products that you guys are developing or the tool side that you are interested in that you think would, that you guys want to start to think about incorporating?
Yeah, good question. We're always looking out for new stuff and evaluating.
Well, I was thinking like AI, like there's some cool stuff coming out, right?
Yeah,
like, I wonder how does that fit into your thoughts around?
We had a team a while ago that was much more focused on AI, and we still are, and we're looking at that. But we've recently kind of split our digital team and expanding it so that we have more of a focus on the early stage research side of things as well. So I'm sure they're going to be looking into more of that, trying to apply AI. And we do have some features that we're starting to build into our apps in that regard that are trying to prompt the user and the patient to look at things and, you know, when they see trends coming and things like that.
Yeah. That's pretty cool. It's interesting, Ed. So I mentioned to my husband that I was interviewing you today, and he goes, "I met Ed." I'm like, "Really? Like, when did you meet Ed?" And he's like, "Oh yeah, Ed, and we went to Ed and Grace's house back when you were at Neos." And I was like, "Really?" I'm like, "I can't even remember that." Like, and so he remembers. You
know who I ran into this summer? Ryan Stewart.
Stuart,
I forgot to mention your name because I thought of you, but because of the pandemic, they didn't open the Philadelphia schools, and it's a shame. Philadelphia pools, sorry.
Pools.
There's a public pool a half a block from my house. I live in downtown Philly now.
And
My kids really enjoyed it because there's a little 2-foot section, and I have a 3- and 4-year-old now. So my wife decided we're going to sign up for some country club pool in Collingswood, you know? And it actually wasn't that far. When we picked them up from the daycare, it was like right over the bridge.
Right.
And I actually rode my bicycle there one time, but we're at this pool one day and I see Ryan Stewart there with his two boys playing in the water and stuff. So I ran into him a couple of times at the pool and caught up. Yeah. Yeah.
He's
doing really well at Glaxo. He's still there, you know? Which I actually got the sign on bonus for him, the recommendation when he interviewed there.
Like that is too
20
funny.
20 years ago or whenever that
I
was.
Know. That's what, and then, so that's what it shocked me. I was like, oh my God, I was trying to remember how long do I know you? And then it was just, you know, by coincidence that Eric Tiburin knew you as well, right? Like that was.
Right. Then we met at More Products when I was consulting there in the mid 90s. That's when I first met Eric.
Yeah. It's a small world, and I know we're all, you know, always connected still. And it's always interesting to me to continuously learn, and that's one of the things and why I do reach out to you and I call you often my go-to guy on this sort of stuff, because you're doing some cutting edge, pretty cool stuff, and willing to share with the community of quality folk, right? And that's what I love about the community that we. The niche area that we are in, it's kind of when people don't know what we do and I try to explain it, they have no clue. Right. And, but I feel more comfortable when I talk to someone like you, because you actually understand exactly the pain points that I've been having over the years. Are you guys thinking about going back to the office yet? Or is that.
We just had a quarterly update meeting last week and the VP of HR spoke and she was saying, voluntary return maybe in late June. And they're talking about fall as, you know, more, I guess, mandatory is what you'd say. But she did say, interestingly enough, that You know, my boss was always a big fan of meet in person because with these Scrum teams, you know, the interaction is really critical to make things happen. Yeah. But I think we've proven that we've still been very productive over the past year. And so in my suggestion to him as well, even 6 months ago, was saying, look, if we have 10 different Scrum teams, why don't you just have, you know, two teams come in one day a week or something like that. That way you don't have all 150, 200 people in our group all in the office in one day.
Right.
You'd have, you know, two dozen or three dozen, you know, every day or every other day or something like that. So we're, our office is going to look much different, not just from the perspective of chairs being taped off and, you know, hand sanitizer everywhere and masks from the table, but they're probably only going to be in there 3 or 4 days a week or something like that. It's kind of the impression that, that I was given.
So it sounds like you guys have been successful and you've kept up your velocity working from home. The, I mean, the overall product quality hasn't diminished at all. I mean, so one could argue, is it really needed, right? I mean, other than lifestyle balance, maybe? I don't know. What are your thoughts there?
Yeah. Well, that's the one thing that I think is going to be a shocker for me because it's been kind of convenient being at home. Other than now, the person I share the office with is my wife, you know, and we're in a pretty small home. So, you know, one person has the desk while the other person's in the kitchen on the counter and you know,
switching down sides.
Right now. So, you know, we're balancing that way. And she actually did return to her office for some period of time, but then went back out again, just because she didn't feel comfortable with the way some of her coworkers were not masked and distancing and stuff that they were doing. So, I think it is going to look a lot different. And I think a lot of companies are realizing that too. There's one employee that, she was going to give her notice and was leaving, one of our contractors, and we're going to try and keep her on board, but she wants to move to Canada. So
Interesting.
She might not be coming back to the office because she's going to basically work remote, but keep doing the same job.
Interesting. Yeah. I mean, I think that there's been a lot of reflection too, right? I think folks have taken this time to do some reflection in general, right? Like what is it that's important and how to do that?
I wish I had a vacation home like in the Poconos or something like that, that I could.
Right. Exactly. This is when you need that escape. Right. Yeah. I know I've done that. I mean, we went and spent some time in Maine and rented a house for a month, right? Just to change venue, right? It wasn't that we went out.
They rented a house in the Catskills for 6 weeks and they took off for like a month and a half.
Because
you could do it if you're working remote.
Absolutely. Is there anything on the, like from, given all of that, like from a technology side that you would want to add to or change about your process or add to your current landscape that would make that any of that easier? I mean, I wonder like, what are you guys using from like communication, like IM and stuff?
We were on Skype for a while and we moved to Slack. And then with the stand up of our independent IT group, as I mentioned, separating from J&J, they got into Microsoft Teams. So it's like our IT group is, and a lot of the corporate folks are more Teams, but the R&D and digital within ourselves are more Slack. We have a lot of chat groups on Slack. So we use both of those tools, Slack and Teams quite a bit, and Teams for meetings now. Our phone system, when we moved into the new building in Malvern, was Ring Central. So we use that for all of our conference calls, the majority of our conference calls. Again, that's kind of slowly migrating towards Teams as well. But with Teams, it doesn't retain the chat as long. The chat history goes away faster on Teams.
Interesting. I didn't know that.
You can't record calls. You can't?
I think that's an admin permission. I think it's per organization you can set up whether or not that is or not. How do you use, how do you like using Slack? So, I mean, this is again, you know, at TX3, we're using Teams like crazy, but like we were evaluating Slack. What do you think about it? How does that work for your teams?
Well, I think like Teams, it's good because the mobile app syncs up well with the PC. So you can go from one tool to the other if you're, you know, going out or moving around, or even like as I was talking to you, I didn't have to disturb my screen. I was Slack chatting with my employee who was asking me some questions, and I was asking him questions about another tool that was coming out. So I've gotten really good at like holding my phone up here where you can't see it, but it looks like I'm still paying attention, but I'm texting in
multitasking,
a Slack message or something. Yeah, exactly. And I don't use video all that often. It's typically just for more one-on-one meetings or meetings where a lot of people are using video, like our manager's meeting generally, where it's only a handful of people. They're all managers and you're all talking. But yeah, for the most part, I don't use a lot of video. But yeah, and then the Slack, I like the way the groups lay out. Like I said, the history lasts longer, so I can scroll back days and look at conversations I've had, if some information or material that's in there that I need to, you know, revisit.
Find.
Whereas Teams, I think after a day or two, your team chat evaporates, right?
Oh, interesting. Yeah, I think that's a setting, because unfortunately, I think I have decades worth of team chats.
On Teams, really? Yeah. Well, maybe it is the way, maybe it's our license or the way our IT group has set up Teams.
Yeah, but, so that it probably doesn't build too fast and then it slows you guys down or whatever.
Right. The other thing that they instituted was even in Outlook, it only retains our emails for a year. So you have to save the email off to a archive directory or something like that if you want to save it.
Yep. So, I think that's all part of moving to 365 Microsoft and all that sort of stuff and size and stuff. But
Well, and the one thing I've done is the Microsoft tools like Cortana. Is that the one? Office assistant or whatever. I've learned to book free time and work time.
Right.
Otherwise,
focus time or whatever
booked,
it's called.
Quadruple booked and
And
just not like have any calendar. Time in the day to do work.
That is a challenge, right? It is the challenge. Cool. Well, Ed, I hope we have an in-person roundtable soon. I can't guarantee that, but I know we did the virtual last fall, but I would love to get everyone back together again sooner.
Yeah, that would be great. Later. Hopefully this October, the timing might work out, right?
Yeah, absolutely. Would you like to leave our listeners with like some best advice or some words of wisdom, some nugget of truth of what maybe they should focus on?
Well, the other thing I would say is be careful with metrics too, because we've tried to drive vendors towards test hours and things like that. Mm-hmm. But it's also making sure your tests are meaningful and results oriented and targeted properly. I think that's one thing that's really key. So it's not just a matter of plowing through and doing tons and tons of automated testing and things. It's making sure that those test results are valuable and that you're testing the right things.
Awesome. Great. Well, thank you, Ed. I enjoyed our conversation. Thank you for your time today. I know you're busy.
Yeah. Thanks, Dory. It's been good.
Thanks for listening to Software Quality Today with Dory Gonzalez-Azevedo. If you like what you just heard, we hope you'll pass along our web address, txthreeservices.com, to your friends and colleagues. And please feel free to leave us a positive review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you subscribe. Also, be sure to check out our archive section on our website for previous episodes. You can also check us out on LinkedIn, Facebook, YouTube, and Twitter at TX3 Services. This has been a TX3 Services production. Join us next time for another edition of Software Quality Today.